Why universalism? For me, the most important part of the universalist half of our Unitarian Universalist heritage is that it has evolved from a focus on universal salvation for all in a next world to a universal call to love the hell out of this world. Today, with the rise of both modern science and religious freedom, which is, of course, found more in certain parts of the world than others, but anyway, at least here in North America, it's much more common than ever, or maybe in the West, it's much more common than ever before, to question the whole concept that some humans will be eternally punished in an afterlife, eternally, infinitely punished for what at most during the, you know, at most 120 years on this earth, that's at most a finite amount of sin, to use the word that's often used, right? Infinite punishment for finite sin seems unjust. But our theological ancestors were born, it's important to remember, into a much different context in which asking that question was much more difficult and profound. In the 1700s in North America, there was widespread anxiety. It's hard to emphasize how much that was the case about whether oneself or one's friends or one's family, whether they were part of the elect or whether they might be eternally separated from you or eternally tortured or punished or tormented. Most infamously, Jonathan Edwards preached a sermon in 1741 on sinners in the hands of an angry God. How many of you read that in school growing up? We certainly did in South Carolina. It was in our, you know, literature textbooks. But thanks in no small part to the universalist tradition, we have come to see that the Calvinistic depiction of a wrathful, vengeful, jealous God ultimately says much more about the intolerance of the people preaching those hellfire and brimstone sermons and maybe some issues that they have than it does about the divine. To adapt a quote from Voltaire, if there is any truth in the teaching that God created humankind in God's image, then humans wasted no time in returning the favor. Indeed, those fire and brimstone sermons were much less about sinners in the hands of an angry God than God in the hands of angry sinners. Into that context, John Murray, who came to be known as the father of American Universalism, arrived in the North American colonies from England in 1770, so 6 years before the Revolution. His message of universal salvation, that all people would eventually be reconciled to God because of God's love, that God is too good to damn people for all of eternity, that no one would be doomed to torment, was a bold, powerful, life-changing message for many people accustomed to damnation from their religious leaders. And a major part of the appeal at that time was he based his reason on the Bible. He said, look at the Bible with me, and I'll show you about God's love and about universal salvation. And although there were previous people who preached similar universalist themes in England and in the U.S. prior to Murray's arrival, Murray sort of particularly galvanized people, and his timing was auspicious. His message of religious freedom that he started 6 years before the American War for Independence came at this call for religious freedom came at the same time that our country was longing for political freedom. So those two dovetailed and complemented one another. Murray preached, and these are his words, give the people, blanketed with a decaying and crumbling Calvinism, something of your new vision. Give them not hell, but hope. That's what people want when they come to church. Not hell, but hope and courage. Do not push them deeper into their theological despair, but preach the kindness and everlasting love of God. And fascinatingly, one of the roots of our contemporary practice of doing child dedications, we do them about twice a year, is that back in the late 1700s, Murray opposed baptisms. He said we universalists should stop doing them, presumably for universalist reasons. That if there's no concerns about hell and washing the baby clean of original sin, then a child dedication is a fully appropriate and sufficient celebration of the hope and joy that's found in each new life that's brought into a religious community. Some of you may recall that a few years ago, the evangelical Christian minister Rob Bell stirred up a lot of controversy and headlines and sold a truck ton of books with his book titled Love Wins. Have any of you read that? Love Wins? Or how many of you saw it about it? Like it was in Time, it was in Newsweek. All right, I saw it. It was out there, promise you. Google it. It's out there. Love Wins, a book about heaven, hell, and the fate of every person who ever lived. Part of this is showing, you know, these aren't questions that you're burdened with, right? You're Unitarian Universalist. So I'm actually, though, less interested in the content of that book, which I still haven't read and don't plan to read. Rob Bell's fine, but it's just that, right? He's struggling with questions that are not my questions. But it signals to me the amount of controversy it generated, the amount of books he sold, that more than 200 years after John Murray began preaching, give them not hell but hope on our shores, the larger culture here is continuing to move toward the message of universalism. And although the stereotype of early Unitarians and Universalists was that Unitarians tended to come from an elite, privileged upper-class part of society and the Universalists from the lower classes, to look at the life of John Murray. And Universalists also tended to be, you know, uneducated. The Unitarians tended to come from Harvard, so they were very polished. But to look at the life of John Murray, there are significant encounters with the powers that be. That's true of other people, but just to look at Murray. When controversy was stirred up about Murray's service during the American Revolutionary War as a chaplain in George Washington's Continental Army, given his universalist theology, which some viewed as a deep heresy, General Washington himself stepped in and supported Murray's appointment in the face of much criticism. At the same time, Murray's first encounter with John and Abigail Adams, and there were many more to come, did not go very well. Murray had traveled back to England at one point, and on the way back to the U.S., he happened to book the same trip back as John and Abigail Adams. And one Sunday, Murray was asked, you know, you're here, you're a preacher, it's Sunday, will you give us a sermon? He said, absolutely. So this is 1788, and Abigail wrote later about that. She said that Murray's sermon was sort of a familiar talking without any kind of dignity, exposing her bias toward, quote, that she would prefer a discourse that would read well. And of course, the Adamses were Unitarians, so that was what they were used to. In 1790, a more social encounter with now Vice President and Mrs. Adams and President Washington went much better, with Murray and his wife Judith bringing congratulations to the new president from the recent Universalist convention. In 1798, Murray renewed his friendship with John Adams, then the new president, and dined with him often and met leaders of the new government. Adams flattered Murray by claiming that Murray had performed a great feat next to a miracle by enticing Vice President Thomas Jefferson to come to church to hear Murray preach. Now, we are often more aware of the ways that our Unitarian forebears were close to the seats of power, but there were well-known and prominent Universalists as well, and I should also note that John Murray's wife, Judith Sargent Murray, was a very active and ardent feminist and advocate for women's rights, and I'll certainly plan a future sermon just about her. She's a really fascinating person. And although there is much more to say about John Murray as well, for now allow me to move on to Hosea Ballou, the leader of the next generation of Universalists. My favorite story of him is when a theologically conservative skeptic — this may have happened many times, but at least one time — that a theologically conservative skeptic came up to him and, you know, shaking his fingers about the ways that Universalism is going to lead to the moral corruption of our youth, right? That's always what happens. If you try to change something, you're going to corrupt the youth. So he said, "Brother Ballou, if I were a Universalist and feared not the fires of hell, I could hit you on the head, steal your horse and saddle right away, and I'd still go to heaven." Hosea Ballou looked over at him and said, "But brother, if you were a Universalist, the idea would never occur to you." Because it really was about an interior change and transformation. Humanists would make a similar point about a century later, that it is very possible to be good with or without God, right? Humanists famously said things like, "I spell my devil without a D, and my God with two O's," right? So God becomes good, devil becomes evil. Along these lines, it's fascinating to see that unlike Murray, who essentially liberalized Calvinism such that everyone became part of the elect, Ballou went much farther theologically. If you remember last week, I said that before the word Unitarian became common, our theological forebears were often known as Arian Christians or Socinian Christians, depending on whether they thought Jesus was just a little bit less than God. So instead of pre-existent for all time, you know, created. So those were the Arian Christians going back to the 4th century Council of Nicaea, or Socinian Christians going back to the 1500s and the Reformation, who thought that Jesus was fully human. So that was the sort of spectrum within Unitarianism, that Jesus could either be a little less than God or fully human. Well, although Ballou was a universalist and not a Unitarian, the universalists tended to be a little more conservative theologically. Ballou came to believe in an Arian Christology. So he came to basically have a Unitarian form of theology, even though he was the prominent universalist of that second generation following Murray. And that's one of the many movements that helped pave the way, well more than a century later, to 1961, when the merger happened of the Unitarians and the Universalists into the Unitarian Universalist Association, giving us a really long name, right? Ballou also made a significant shift in his understanding of the atonement. So that word atonement, for those of you who didn't grow up with a lot of Christian theology, think at-one-ment. So it's how do you make again at one? How do you unify again the divine and the human that have become separated in that traditional conception by sin, right? Eve ate the apple. We don't have time to unpack all that this morning. It's wrong, right? Okay. I'll teach a class later that don't believe the propaganda. Okay. Murray, like many early Universalists, essentially expanded a Calvinist perspective from a limited atonement that Jesus sacrificed himself on the cross for only a small elect to Jesus' death being a universal sacrifice for all people, all times, and all places. But this still often depicts God the Father, right, requiring the death, the really torturous death of Jesus the Son, as part of atonement, as part of salvation. And if you take just one step back and aren't just sort of within that tradition, that looks a lot like divine child abuse, right? As people started to notice. In contrast, Ballou started to teach that it was just humanity that needed to be reconciled, to realize that God's love is always there if we'll turn away from our own narcissism and toward God's love. So that started a really important shift in Universalist theology, leading to the merger of Unitarianism and Universalism. There's, again, so much more to say about Universalist history. Indeed, the two-volume history of the Universalist Church in America that goes from 1770, when Murray landed on our shores, to 1970, that 200-year history, weighs in at 1,800 pages. There is a shorter 150-page version the summary. But for now, just allow me to offer just a few additional highlights. There was significant process. So you heard some about Maria Cook. There was significant progress, really breakthrough progress, in American Universalism regarding the role of women and women's ordination. What's called breaking the stained glass ceiling, right? Such that by the time women gained the right to vote, the 19th Amendment in 1920 in our country, 88 women had already been ordained as Universalist ministers. Still too small a number. I mean, now well more than half of our Unitarian Universalist ministers are women. But that was really significant in the 1920s. At that time, Unitarians had ordained 42, about half the number that the Universalists had. These numbers, again, though relatively small, were path-breaking. It would be another half century before the ordination of women became anything like commonplace in this country. In 1889, Joseph Jordan became the first African-American ordained as a Universalist minister. It's no accident that Sojourner Truth's famous Ain't I a Woman speech at a women's rights convention, that was held at a Universalist congregation. The Universalist message of universal love for all people in this world led Universalists to become early advocates for social justice causes, from the abolition of slavery to women's rights to prison reform. Along these lines, another famous Universalist was Clara Barton, who became the first American president of the American Red Cross. Now, as I move toward my conclusion, allow me to briefly address further the trajectory that, you know, so we've been talking about why Unitarianism, why Universalism. So let me say just a little bit more about that trajectory that led to the consolidation, that led to the merger of these two traditions in 1961. The most important influence on the Universalist side was the increasingly vocal call among Universalists themselves to fully live into that name, Universalist. Around 1896, a spokesperson for the Universalists said, "You Universalists have spotted," and I don't know why he didn't say we, because he was a Universalist, but he said you. So, "You Universalists have squatted on the biggest word in the English language. Now the world is beginning to want that big word. And you Universalists must either improve the property or move off the premises." Similarly, in 1943, the general superintendent of the Universalists said to the annual General Assembly, "Universalism cannot be limited to either Protestantism or to Christianity, not without denying its very name. Ours is a world fellowship, not just a Christian sect. For so long as universalism is universalism and not particularism, the fellowship bearing its name must succeed in making it unmistakably clear that all are welcome. Theist and humanist, Unitarian and Trinitarian, colored and colorless, a circumscribed universalism is unthinkable." So why universalism? You can see that Unitarianism can sometimes lead down a road to what's called extreme Emersonian individualism. You know, that Thomas Jefferson, right? I'm content to be a Unitarian alone by myself. You know, Emerson was fine just with a walk in the woods. That's the path that Unitarianism can sometimes lead to, caring most about one's own isolated spirituality. But the Universalist half of our heritage calls us out of ourselves, into the world, definitively. That's what it is, that it's universal. It's not just about Unitarian. It's not just about you. It's universal. It calls us into a world filled with far too much hell that desperately needs the life-saving message that we are part of one another, part of one human family. And as we prepare to go from this place and into the next week, I invite you to allow John Murray's historic words to ring in your ear, especially in the next week, to potentially change the way you might otherwise interact with everyone you will encounter this next week. If Murray were here today, he would call us to give everyone we meet not hell, but hope. That after meeting you, they're left not with more hell, but with more hope. More hope and courage, to not push them deeper into whatever despair they have in their life, but to give them kindness and love. Together, may we do our part, together and individually, to love the hell out of this world.